Today's Taisho will be on case 8 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 8, Suigan's Eyebrows. Engo's Introduction. An enlightened person enjoys perfect freedom in active life. He or she is like a dragon supported by deep waters, or like a tiger that commands its mountain retreat. The person who is not enlightened drifts about in the affairs of the world. They are like a ram that gets its horns caught in a fence, or a man who waits for a rabbit to run against a tree stump and stun itself. The enlightened person's words are sometimes like a lion crouched to spring, sometimes like the Diamond King's treasure sword. Sometimes their effort is to shut the mouths of the world-famous ones. Sometimes it is as if they follow the waves coming one after another. When the enlightened person meets others who are enlightened, then friend meets friend. They value them and they encourage each other. When they meet those who are adrift in the world, then a teacher meets disciple. Their way of dealing with such people is helpful. They stand firm before them like a 1,000-foot cliff. Therefore, it is said that the way of the Absolute is manifest everywhere. It has no fixed rules and regulations. The teacher sometimes makes a blade of grass stand for the golden-faced Buddha, 16 feet high, and sometimes makes the golden-faced Buddha, 16 feet high, stand for a blade of grass. Tell me, on what principle is all this based? Do you understand? See the following. Main subject. Suigan, at the end of the summer session, spoke to the assembly and said, "During the summer session, I have talked to you a great deal. Now look, has Suigan any eyebrows?" Ofuku said, "He who commits theft has a guilty conscience." Choke said, "They've grown." Umon said, "Kan." Secho's verse, Suigan's words, unanswerable in thousands of years. Umon's Kan, losing his money, committing a crime. Hofuku is a dotard. Was he nimble or did he mumble? Long-tongued Suigan, definitely a thief. Flawless is the jewel. Who can appreciate the priceless? Choke knew well, he said, "They've grown." Today is the first day of our August Sesshin, and it's a beautiful day. Huh? Last night was quite different. Right? When we arrived here, the air was so thick, so humid. Sometimes you know that in August in New Jersey, it's hard to imagine anything more humid. And in that kind of weather, it's like you're almost moving through warm water all the time. And there's no real place to get cool if you're outside or you're not in an artificial environment, because the humidity's just everywhere. And then those beautiful beautiful storm came last night. All that lightning and thunder. And now this morning, this is like an autumn day. It's just beautiful. So it's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to practice beautiful sitting this morning. Some of you are here for the first time. Some of you are here at Sesshin for the first time. And some of you are here sitting, doing Zen meditation for the first time. So maybe I should offer a few words of explanation. What we're doing right now is called a teisho. It's a talk on Zen practice. Zen practice is a little bit of strange. It's kind of strange. Because a talk in Zen practice is not like a lecture in school. See, all of us spend a lot of time sitting at a desk listening to somebody rattle on. Right? I mean, most Americans have finished high school, and so that means that for at least 12 years, and in some cases more than 12 years, people have been sitting in a desk listening to somebody talk. And a lot of people go to college, to junior college or to college, so you get 2 to 4 years of talk, and then if you go to graduate school, you get additional years of lectures and talks. This is not quite like that, you know. Because all of those talks are really a mixed bag. You know, all of those talks we get in our lives are really a mixed bag. Because, people tell us things, people in authority tell us things that just may not be true. You know, may not be true. You can have a teacher in your experience who says things, and later in your life you might discover that some of the things that person said were simply false. You know, simply maybe the teacher said something about a president of the United States, and later you realize that your teacher didn't know what he or she was talking about. You know. Those kinds of lessons are somewhat easily corrected because they're just matters of fact. But sometimes we get lessons that are more enduring, and they're mistaken lessons, but we don't, it's not so easy to find out, you know. So, as we grow up, people give us all kinds of lessons about life, about what we should think and what we should do. And, it's difficult to know, really, after a certain point, it's difficult to know whether we're believing something because we believe it or because somebody in authority told us it was true. This is actually a big problem. You know, you grow up and all of these people, all of them are teachers in a certain way, you know. And they tell you certain things, and you think, okay, he's a teacher, or he's my coach, or she's my aunt, you know. They must know what they're talking about. I'm just a kid, they're adults, you know, and I should believe what they say. And we sort of try often to be a good student, right? So when I was in the 10th grade, was it the 10th grade? I think it was, when I was in the 8th grade, I had to take Algebra 1. And I had not been a very good student in school until then. And I had to take Algebra 1, and I started failing Algebra 1. Because I couldn't, you know, it would be 2x plus 3y equals 10. You know, and I just couldn't figure that out. I didn't know what those x's were and what those y's were. And I didn't get it. I just didn't get it. And my father, he was the worst teacher, you know, because he'd start working on them, and if I didn't get them right, he'd go, no, no, not like that, you know. He'd get panicky, you know, if I weren't, and then he'd have a hard time with it, too. So if I, you know, couldn't really go to my dad, and my mother was a very sweet person, but she really didn't have a very good education. She was from a very rural part of the upstate New York, and really, she probably had about the equivalent of about a 9th grade education. So she had never taken algebra. So my father had taken algebra, but he couldn't remember any of it, and he would have a nervous breakdown trying to work out the problems. and yell at me. So I just drifted hopelessly. And I had a very good teacher, a very nice person, a very kind woman, who wouldn't let me fail algebra. She kept saying, I'm not going to let you fail. And I kept thinking, please, let me fail. But she said, I'm not going to let you fail algebra. And halfway through the year, I figured out how to do algebra. It was like a miracle. And I started, you know, I could just sail through these problems. And I got like Fs all the way through the first half and As all the way through the second half. And I think she gave me like an A for the year or something. And I had to do a lot of makeup work and things like that. But I would just go in and take these tests and everybody would still be working and I'd be done. And I'd turn it in and she'd say, if you want to double your grade, just do the test a second time. And I could do this test twice, you know, in the same time that other people were doing it once. And it wasn't that I was smarter. I just figured out how to do this, you know. So after that, I realized I could be a good student. You know, I realized I don't have to be an idiot. I can be a good student. So, you know, I started taking school seriously. Only I took it too seriously. You know, so if it were history, you know, I'd really read the history. You know, I'd read it And then, you know, I'd come in and the teacher would say, well, you know, somebody tell me about Andrew, you know, Jackson. And I'd have my, you know, hand up, way, you know. And of course, he'd go, yes, Kurt, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And then he'd ask another question. Well, he did want me to answer that one too, see. He wanted somebody else to answer that question. But I'd have my hand up and I'd be, squirming, please, call me, you know. I became addicted to the approval of my teachers, really. I mean, I really became like addicted. I so much loved not being a dummy, you know, because I had thought of myself as dumb. And then all of a sudden I was getting really good grades and I thought, my God, I'm not dumb, I'm smart, you know. So I realized, you know, I could be smart, you know. Oh my gosh, who would have thought, you know? And then I really got addicted to being smart, you know, to being thought of as smart. And I really wanted my teachers to applaud me, you know, and to, you know. And so I did virtually anything that if they had said, please stand on your head, I would have just done a headstand, you know. When I went to college, I was the same way, you know. If my teachers liked a certain writer, oh, I loved that. You know, I'd be in Professor Duckworth's class on the novel, and he'd say, you know, of all the British writers, Jane Austen has the greatest insight. You know, and later on, if I were having a beer with some friends, some who were also English majors, I might say, you know, of all the English writers, Jane Austen has the deepest insight, you know. See, that's how it works, right? At some point, you might just go through life like that, right? So if a crisis happens, you might say, well, what would, you know, if somebody gives you a book to read and says, what did you think of the book? You could say, well, what would Professor Duckworth say, you know? Well, it's good, but it's not as good as Jane Austen. You know? Right? See? That's how you could do it. You know, how would Duckworth approach this? See? Or you could, maybe you had a high school teacher. You say, what would Mrs. Brown say about this? That's one way to live, right? But every once in a while, you know, we realize that by following the advice of other people, we are not necessarily becoming a happier person, and our life is not necessarily becoming a richer life. You know, so we're getting good grades in all kinds of ways, and we're doing what we were told in all kinds of ways, and in our minds, you know, we're still in the eighth grade trying not to be a dummy. Or we're, we're in the 11th grade and we have our hand up and our bright face and we're waiting for Mrs. Smith to call on us, see. But you know, then the next thing you know, you're 30 years old and for some reason you're not happy. You know, and something's empty in your life. This happens to people all the time. And it might be that somebody gives you a book and says, well, what do you think of this book? But it might be bigger issues, right? I mean, you might be living in a certain way, and one day you might get up and just say, you know, I don't like my life. You know, I don't like who I am. And you might say, well, how did this happen to me? Because I did everything I was supposed to do. You know, my father said, do this, and I did it. My mother said, do this, and I did it. You know? And now I'm 40 years old, or I'm 30 years old, and I'm so unhappy, or my life seems so empty. And I think this is quite common. You know, people who love us give us advice, and we take their advice because they love us, you know? And we try to be the person they want us to be. But then, you know, you can get up one day and say, I'm not happy with my life. I'm not happy. I don't even know who I am. See, that's a fascinating thing. You know, you meet people, and it's not so much, you know, people have a desperate hunger to do something. And they haven't done it. You do meet people like that every once in a while, right? Once in a while you meet people like that. The other night, my wife was watching a movie called Schmidt Gets the Blues. It's a foreign film, and it's about a guy in Germany who's very unhappy. He's like a 60-year-old man, and he's totally bored. And he goes to the doctor because he thinks something's wrong with him. The doctor says, you know, you're fine. There's nothing wrong with you. And he says, but he doesn't really know why he's unhappy or why he doesn't feel well. And then the doctor says, you know, I've never really wanted to be a doctor. I really wanted to be an opera singer. And he starts singing opera in the examining room, you know? And you realize, you know, neither of these guys have ever done what they really wanted to do. They've just been doing what they were supposed to do. And eventually the character in this actually leaves Germany with his accordion. He's listening to the radio one. He plays polka, you know, oompa oompa type stuff. And he listens to the radio one night and he hears Zydeco, which is a different style of playing the accordion. He thinks he's hooked, right? It's like it starts haunting him, the Zydeco music, you know? And he can't, and he goes to these places and they're playing the tubas, you know, German type stuff. It's horrible, right? He said, boom, 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 boom. And, you know, and Schmidt can't stand it anymore. He's so bored. Not that polka's bad, I don't mean that. You might be a polka fan. I didn't mean to step on anybody's toes. So if you like polka, it's marvelous. But the sameness of it, it drives him crazy, right? And he hears this crazy Zydeco music, which you might know is from New Orleans, and it's got bells, and it's very up-paced, and a lot of, I don't know how to put it, but it's very spicy music, right? He just leaves Germany and he goes to New Orleans. And he's sailing around in a little boat trying to find people who play Zydeco music up and down the bayous, and he actually meets all these interesting people. So this is like a case of somebody who the doctor is somebody who was doing what his dad said and his mom said, become a doctor, and he really wanted to be an opera singer. So that's one kind of person, but you also meet people who don't know what they want. You know, they're 50 years old and you say, well, what do you want to do? And they say, I don't know. I've never actually done what I wanted to do and I don't even know what I want to do. See? And that's a very interesting situation, right? I mean, how do people get like that? But, you know, a lot of people get like that. Maybe everybody's like that. You know, at some point in our lives, we begin to wonder, you know, we begin to realize that we're not living naturally. We're not really, there's something inside of us that wants to come out And we don't know what it is, but we know it's locked up inside of us. And it might be the desire to be an opera singer. It might be that we have this craving for a different kind of accordion music. But who knows? But I think that people get interested in Zen meditation because there's something inside of them that wants to come out, and they don't know how to let it out, and they've been, good people all their lives, which is important. They've done what they were told, but it hasn't come out. I hope that makes some sense. So Zen is for people who feel there's something in there that they want to let go, let out, let free. And Zen is all about how to let it free. It's really about being true to your true nature. There's something inside you that wants to come out, and what is it you don't know? But Zen is about letting it out, and being true to it. Being true to that. And we don't necessarily know how to do that, though, because all we've ever done is sort of imitate. We've been the people, other people wanted us to be. So if somebody says, go ahead, be your true self, you might actually say, I have no idea who I am. Zen is all about encountering that true nature, that true self. And there's no sense somebody telling you who to be or what's in there. If somebody tells you, then it could just be another teacher. So the Zen method is different. We sit on a cushion and we watch the breath, and little by little, you go, it's like if you sit on a cushion, you straighten your back and you breathe through your abdomen and you squeeze the breath out and you watch the breath, even if you thought your mind was calm, what you're going to notice is that your mind is full of thoughts. It's actually like racing with thoughts, you're going to have to watch your breath for a long time before you suddenly can be in the moment. Every once in a while you'll notice that the thoughts are not so pressing and that you can be in the moment for just a few seconds. And then the thoughts come back. And then you're in the moment for just a few seconds, and then these thoughts come back. And sometimes the thoughts can be trivial. You sit down on the cushion and you're watching your breath, and the thoughts are popping up, and you're thinking, "Oh gosh, I've got to get that bill. Got to get that bill in the mail." Or, "Oh, the paint is peeling on the garage. What am I going to do?" Okay. But if you keep going, if you keep meditating, after a while, the kinds of thoughts that come up are not so logical. But they might be memories, they might be little bits and pieces of information, they might be things you have forgotten about for 20 years. And if you keep going, you keep trying to come back to the moment, eventually things come up that could be disturbing, things that happened to you when you were a kid. Remember a time somebody hurt your feelings or something, and you'll find all these emotions in there. Well, what's going on is that, actually, when we sit on the cushion and we watch the breath with a straight back, we're just trying to keep the mind in the moment, but it's very, very difficult for humans to be in the moment, just naturally present, because all of our lives we've been pretending to be what other people want us to be. And we pretended to see what other people wanted us to see. And it's very interesting. And that's just, everybody wants us to see something a certain way. And we go along to get along, So it's hard even just to be in the moment without trying to imitate people. I can tell you a little story about this. When I was in high school, I was very shy, and not only was I not a very good student until the eighth grade, but I was like really shy. And when I was in about the 10th or 11th grade, I decided that I was going to try to be more sociable. And so I went to the store and bought some shirts that I thought were beautiful shirts. I thought, why don't I dress more, in a more cool way, instead of like. So I my mother was a very nice person, and she let me go to the store and buy some clothes. And I bought a lime green shirt and a yellow, like a canary yellow shirt. These were like polo shirts, and like a canary yellow shirt. And I actually bought like a yellow pair of pants, Really, you might think I'm lying, but I swear this is who I was, These were like summer clothes, right? Or, So anyway, I just thought, well, I'm going to, really let my, as we used to say, let my freak flag fly. I'm going to let my, let it all hang out here, So I remember I came to school one day, and I would wear this stuff quite often, but there was a guy in my high school named Tommy Worley. And I was on the way to class very unselfconsciously thinking, but life is so good, I've got my I've got my yellow pants and my gold polo shirt on, And Tommy said, "Oh, Kurt," and he said, "Oh, you look great, are you going to the races today?" In other words, he was saying, you look like somebody he'd be going to the horse races, sort of a low-class guy, right? You don't get the joke, but I said, "Oh, going to the races today, man." So it was a put-down, right? It was like, ow! So after that, I had to tone down my clothes. So anyway, now I wear black polo shirts, and nobody can criticize me, So the thing is, this goes on in our lives all the time. It's very hard to be in the moment, very hard to be in the moment. As we really are present in the moment and not try to see what we're supposed to see, what people want us to see or told us we should see. So you sit on the cushion and try to be in the moment, and you know what happens is that your mind starts replaying all the lessons. All the little bits of information, all the lectures, all the times when your aunt pulled you aside and told you blah, 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 or your uncle said, "We don't wear gold polo shirts in this family," whatever. All of that conditioning is in there, right? And you just have to work through it. You work through it. And it's very powerful. Last Saturday, at the Saturday sit, I was talking about some research. There was some new research that some psychologists did. And they were working with children 3 to 5 years old. And they found that if you take some carrots, you have a pile of little baby carrots. Perhaps you like to eat those baby carrots. They're good, right? The raw baby carrots. They took some baby carrots and put them in a regular little bag. And they put some other little baby carrots, same carrots, in a little bag that had a McDonald's emblem on it. See? And they asked the kids, 3 to 5 years old, to say which carrots are better. Or they all rated the McDonald's carrots as better, just because it had a logo on it. So the carrots tasted better, right? Because of the conditioning they received. So how do carrots really taste? That's an interesting issue. And by the time you're 5 years old, you've already been given all of these lessons that control how you experience the world. So when you're 30 years old, you might say, or 40 years old, "I'm so unhappy. I wonder why." The reasons are not obvious. But when you sit on the cushion, all of a sudden, it's like all of these tapes that you have, like a lifetime library of lectures and instructions and observations that you're supposed to accept. It's like all of a sudden the tapes start playing. And you keep pulling your attention back to the moment, back to the moment. little by little, little by little, it becomes possible to experience the moment just as it is. Not as it's supposed to be, but as it actually is. And this is a great achievement, because people think they experience this all the time, but we're actually like, we actually have like a haunted mind. We actually are constantly afraid to experience the moment because it might not be what we were told we should experience. See? Zen is all about being natural. Being natural. Little by little, cleaning away all of those lessons, all of those lectures, and just experiencing the moment as it is. And it might take you all day to have a little experience of pure presence, you know, where you're just in the moment, thought has ceased, and you're resting serenely at one with your attention, whatever is the object of your attention. And when that happens, generally speaking, people feel great. They're happier, you know. It's like going home. It's like you've been wandering around, and all of a sudden, you encounter your home. Or it's like seeing your face in the mirror for the first time, you know. It's like when we experience the world as it actually is. You know, it's not a terrifying place, as it turns out. It could be very hot and humid, or it could be very cold, but there's something quite refreshing, no matter what. Even if we're sitting, last night, you know, I was sitting here in these robes, they're actually quite hot, you know, and I was just literally just sweating up a storm. And when I would move, you know, my clothes are kind of sticky, so it's a little bit icky and unpleasant. You know, if you go into deep samadhi, deep concentration, that, you know, pleasant and unpleasant disappear, and the pure presence of the moment is there. And even in the most stifling humidity and heat, you can feel truly wonderful. You know, actually, there's nothing more wonderful than having humidity of 99% in New Jersey and temperature 99, and just sitting on your cushion and feeling the sweat roll down your brow, actually. It might not sound inviting, but if you're in deep samadhi, it's wonderful. It's wonderful experience. Zen is all about sweeping aside all of these lectures, all of these lessons, all of these stories that tell us how we're supposed to think and behave and who we're supposed to be. And it just experience the moment as it is. Yeah. And little by little, if we do this, we become a different kind of person. You know, because instead of looking to others for approval, we are encountering the world as it is. And there's a part of us that begins to grow very alive when we live that way. You know, it becomes very alive. It's like behind there's a kind of true self, we say in Zen, true nature. You know, inside of us, behind all of these walls and all of these curtains which we've constructed, there's like actually this beautiful empty space. Yeah. It's like a room, you know, it's like you open the door and there's a curtain, and then you open the curtain and there's another curtain and another curtain, and then there's a door and then there's a curtain, you know. You keep going, going, going. You open the last door and there's this beautiful empty space. It's like sunlight's on the floor and it's a beautiful autumn day. And beautiful, or it's like a cloudless sky. It's like you open the door and suddenly there's a cloudless sky. And it's no obstructions. It has no qualities, no birth and no death. This is like a true nature. This is an essential, at the core of awareness is this empty space, this beautiful empty space. And we call this true nature, but there's, to say there's something there is actually not quite accurate. But, you know, when you enter that space, you feel so wonderful. And if you live your life there, it's a different kind of life. Because instead of responding to things timidly, and, you know, usually we have this expression, I'm of two minds about that, you know. Somebody will say, well, what do you think? And you say, well, I'm of two minds about that. You know, do you want to go to dinner or not? Well, I'm of two minds about that. You know, my mother would have said, don't go to dinner, but my father would have said, go to dinner. That's where two minds comes from, by the way, see. We are of two minds when we're not in contact with true nature. And people go through life of two minds, right? So, you know, should I go into my boss and say, I want a raise? I'm of two minds about that, see. Uncle Ted would have said, yeah, be a man, see. But my Aunt Joan would have said, you get more flies with honey than with sugar, right? See, different lessons, different authorities. So what do I do? I'm of two minds. So we go through our life like this all the time. You know, divided, divided, divided. We can't, you know, even just experiencing the moment is very difficult because we're of two minds. Right. Always, there's always all these lessons between us and the world. So Zen is like, you know, the method is just to keep trying to be in the moment. And all this junk arises and we sweep it away, we sweep it away. And first, you know, there's just these little moments. You go into lunch one day and you look down and there's a bowl of rice. There's an empty bowl. And then the next thing you know, you've put rice in the bowl, and you're looking at the bowl of rice, and you're just staring at the rice, and there isn't a thought in your head, right? And far from being stupidity, this is liberation. See, because for the first time, you're experiencing things as they are, not as somebody told you they should be, or as you think they should be, right? So this is really, I think Zen is like nothing else in the world. I think this is really a wonderful path, you know? It's like, you know, you sit on the cushion and it's maybe a 99% humidity and it's 90 degrees at 9 o'clock at night, you know. And you're sitting there and you're thinking, oh, cripes, I really hate this, you know. And you sit there and think, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. Or you might think, oh, I hate it, but that's good for me, see. Because Uncle Joe always said, if it hurts, it must be good, right? You know, so, right? There's various attitudes, right? You could take, you could say, I hate it. You could say, but hating it is good. You know, you could say, this is unhealthy. You know, what would Dr. Phil say? You know, Dr. Phil would say, this is not healthy. You know, or, you know, so you could go through all the mental attitudes, right? All the advice, all the possible interpretations. And then, you know, if you don't get off the cushion and run away, if you just stay there, at some point, it doesn't matter whether it's hot or cold, you know, low humidity, high humidity. And suddenly, it's beautiful. It's like you're entering that empty room inside yourself, and everything is just, you know, it's like everything that arises is like a cloud blowing across the sky. The blue sky, you know, it's beautiful. It's beautiful to be hot. It's beautiful to be cold, you know. Wonderful. Suigan, at the end of the summer session, spoke to the assembly and he said, during the summer session, I have talked to you a great deal. In other words, this is like they have in Zen practice what's called an ango, or a season of practice. So the ango might start in the spring and it might end around now, and it begins and ends with a sashin, see? And it's the end of maybe the summer ango, the summer season of practice. And he's giving a teisho, and he says, during this whole ango, you know, I've been doing a teisho every day at Sashin and once every 2 weeks on Saturday. And I've talked to you a great deal, a lot of words, you know. But please pay no attention to what I'm saying. You know, please don't try to be a good student. You know, don't hold on to my words. Get rid of my words. And he says, now look, has Suigan any eyebrows? See, for 4 months or 3 months, you've been listening to me rattle on our native language, whatever it is, and basically you have had seen ideas come and go. But what about this moment right here? You know, are you in the moment as it really is, or are you trying to have some kind of experience? See? And if the answer is I'm trying to have some kind of experience, then you're definitely not in the moment as it really is. You know, and so, you know, all of us come to Sesshin, all of us come to Zen looking for some kind of experience. You know, maybe we think, this is the Sesshin where I'll have my Dai Kensho. I'll have a great awakening experience. So we're sitting on the cushion thinking, I've got to have Dai Kensho, I've got to, you know. Or we're thinking, maybe I'll answer my koan this time. So we're on the cushion thinking, you know, where's that answer? Where, you know. But that's very unnatural, see? And answering your koan can be like being the student in class whose hand is always up, right? It's like, I've got the answer, you know, call on me. You know, it's okay not to have the answer, first of all. And, you know, if you stay on the cushion and you just stay with your koan and you keep your mind empty, you'll become one with your koan, and you'll have the quote-unquote answer automatically. But if you're striving to have some kind of a special experience, you're just imitating again, see. So please don't expect anything of the moment except what it actually is. And all you have to do is purify your body, heart, and mind, and then that condition will be easy to maintain. And that's heaven itself, by the way, right? Just being able to be at ease with what's actually the case is heaven. Yeah. You know? So whether you answer your koan or not, whether you have Dai Kensho or not. Suigan, at the end of the summer session, spoke to the assembly and he said, look, I've been babbling on, but do I have any eyebrows or not? Now, this is from a folk belief. It was thought in Chinese Buddhism that if you said something bad about Buddhism, or if you gave a false teaching, your eyebrows would fall out, right? So, in other words, don't believe, you know, that's the wisdom of, you know, that's Uncle Joe, right? Uncle Joe always said that if I said a bad thing, my eyebrows would fall out, you know? But Uncle Joe was full of beans, right? So it's just another ridiculous falsehood. Has Suigan any eyebrows or not, he says. Now, Hofuku said, hearing about this story, Zen Master Hofuku said, he who commits theft has a guilty conscience. In other words, he said, well, look, you've been talking to them all summer. You've made it more difficult for them to wake up. So he's sort of saying, you've just muddied the waters with all these talks. Choke said, they've grown. Umon said, God. And they've grown. Your eyebrows, far from dropping out, they've gotten longer. So we can someday work on what that means, you know. But today we're here practicing this beautiful path. And it's a great pleasure to sit with all of you. Let's have no expectations. but just practice being here, present in the moment. Whatever arises is Buddha. You know, so it makes it wonderful. And one last thing, I want to apologize to any polka fans out there. Because indeed, people do, you know, I'm sorry. It's a wonderful musical tradition. I just meant in the context of the movie, it had become unbearable for him. Okay.
Thank you.